Your day breaks, your mind aches. You find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up. She takes her time and doesn't feel she has to hurry. She no longer needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years. You want her, you need her, and yet you don't believe her when she says her love is dead. You think she needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears.
Hello again and welcome to I've Got a Beatles podcast, and today it's just Dave coming at you. I'm very excited to be at the National Conference of the Society for Music Theory and to have the opportunity to interview someone who's very familiar with the Beatles and has done a lot of work with the Beatles, but from different angles than we're normally used to talking about on the show. And so I'd like to welcome Professor John Kovach to the show. He's the professor of music theory and director at the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester, and also teaches at the Eastman School of Music. He's published lots of articles on topics in popular music and 12-tone music, philosophy, aesthetics of music, several books about rock music, a textbook that I'll ask you about a little bit later, and especially known, you may have seen him if you've taken his Coursera course about the Beatles too. So I'd like to welcome Professor Kovach to the show.
Well, thanks, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I think you picked a great first song to get us in here. I asked him to pick three songs that mean something to him and he finds it interesting. So yeah. What do you like about For No One?
Well, this is a great Paul song. It's one of his songs that's kind of about alienation. On the same album, Revolver, you've got Eleanor Rigby, right, which is about an old woman who lives in the church there, probably the caretaker of the church. She's very lonely. The priest is very lonely. And you get a verse about her, you get a verse about him, and then when they finally come together, it's after she's died and he's doing the burial. And so it's a kind of a sad song with no happy ending about alienation. For No One is to me awesome because it's not about alienation, but the way in which he deals with that track, that song, and deals with alienation in that song in a different kind of way. That's about alienation inside a marriage. Two people who are married, and the one, it seems in the song, it's the woman, has fallen out of love with the man. And so it's about the pain the man feels continuing to live with a woman that he still loves but that no longer loves him. And so it's like a kind of day in, day out kind of pain that you hear a lot about, the everyday life and the pain that it causes him. And what I think is fantastic about the tune is that if you look at it from a music theoretical point of view, the song ends with a very inconclusive cadence. And so it's as if you put that song on loop, it could just continue to loop and loop around again and again without ever ending. And it's a great kind of musical solution to what this guy's day must feel like every day, looping around to the same kind of pain. And so I think it's a great musical analog to what the lyrics are talking about. And there's the fact that it's not one of those Paul songs you've heard a million times. So unlike, say, Eleanor Rigby or Penny Lane or She's Leaving Home, maybe She's Leaving Home is another one you don't hear a lot, but a lot of the others, it's not that you get tired of them, but it's nice to have this little gem that maybe not as many other people really sort of think about or talk about. So it's kind of a favorite for that reason, too.
Well, that's excellent, and I think that gives us kind of a sense of your perspective on how you look at this music, because it's not necessarily, you look at it as a fan, you love the music, but also kind of looking at the parts, the structure.
And too, For No One is a great one to point out that he uses the French horn for one of the verses, but that is kind of the precursor to the use of the piccolo trumpet in Penny Lane.
Yeah.
Right? And it's all part of the sort of Paul, the category we might call Paul uses classical music, you know, that goes all the way back to Yesterday, and so it fits in all those kinds of ways too.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about another song a little bit later here, but I think that sets the stage really well and the way you think about music. So how did you get into the Beatles, and what's your own musical background?
Well,
if you look at pictures of John on the internet, you're always with a guitar.
Well, I was born in 1959, so I remember the Beatles in 1964. I remember all the excitement around Beatlemania. I saw A Hard Day's Night in the theater when it first came out. I can remember very distinctly my grandmother taking me to the Terrace Theater on Plymouth Road in Redford, Michigan. I grew up outside of Detroit. And the minute the film came on, all the girls in the theater started screaming, and I was only 5, and I wish they would sit down because I couldn't. I'm a short little guy. I couldn't see the screen, you know.
But
can just imagine the excitement of that. Me and my friends, we just loved those Beatles records. My dad, the first Beatles record he bought me was the Beatles' second album, which was a kind of an American-only follow-up to Meet the Beatles. He went out to get Meet the Beatles, but they didn't have any more, and they just released the second album. And I remember that what we used to do is we used to put the record on one of those old record players that, you know, where you tape the nickel to the tone arm and you put it on there. And we were five, 6 years old, you know, we would play the record, and we were so excited about the music, we'd sing the songs and jump on the bed, you know, until my mother came in and said, "You kids, stop jumping on the bed, you're gonna knock an eye out with that thing," or something. But that was just how, we just had to release the excitement we had for the music. And so, you know, from that point on, it wasn't too long before I had some guitar lessons and, you know, was playing guitar all along, and all I really wanted to do through most of junior high and high school was be a professional musician, and so that's the direction I went in for a long time, and then ended up turning toward the academic study of music as we got into the 80s, but continued to keep my playing active, you know, and so these days I don't have to hide it. Back when I was in graduate school at the University of Michigan in the 80s, you had to hide that because, you know, if you were in music school and you were basically a rocker at heart, nobody was going to take you seriously. That was just an invitation to be dismissed immediately. But these days, it's much different. Now, if you study popular music, it's a career advantage in academia.
Definitely.
So things have changed quite a bit.
That was something I was going to ask you about is, for people who aren't familiar with music academics, if there's classical music, canon is really the privileged kind of body of music.
Yeah.
And so what kind of resistance did you face to study? That's a two-part question. So what kind of resistance did you face being able to have your work accepted, I guess?
Yeah.
And then secondly, how do you approach the music? And do you approach the music in a way like you're analyzing Beethoven?
Yeah.
Or, and then, you know, some people, I have students who'll say, "Oh, but that kills the music if you talk about it with, you know, Beethoven terms." Or,
yeah, if you think about it too much, you ruin the spontaneity.
And right, just, all that stuff.
Squeeze all the life out of it, and it becomes a dry academic exercise.
Yeah.
Well, we did have trouble at first getting people in the academy to take popular music seriously. Now, I must say, when I say at first, I'm talking about the second half of the 80s and the early 90s. A lot of people were teaching popular music at universities, but it was mostly English professors teaching, you know, Dylan lyrics, or they would look at songs like Eleanor Rigby. But most English professors, even if they are pretty good musicians, don't talk about music in the classroom because they're a little bit intimidated by the real musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Who, you know, among people who aren't musicians, they think we musicians have some kind of magical power,
yes.
And they don't want to be exposed by our superior sort of abilities in music. And so you can understand how they would stay away from the music.
Mm-hmm.
And musicology and music theory, for many, many years, were very conservative disciplines. I don't mean conservative politically. Most musicologists and theorists are probably liberals. But in terms of their taste in music, they really stuck with classical music and have continued to stick with classical music long after most of the rest of the culture has moved on. When you think about it, the two styles of music that are really big in schools of music right now in terms of the curriculum are classical and jazz. But when you look at the marketplace, classical and jazz together only take up 3% of the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So the other 90% of the music is music we usually don't talk about, at least normally talk about in music school. And so that's changed in the last 10 or 15 years. And now it's changing even more broadly and more rapidly. Everybody's talking about curriculum change and bringing the music in. But at first, you know, we had to fight against people who, not so much fight, but really struggle against people who thought, well, that music is fine for recreation purposes, but it's not really serious music. Yeah. I mean, trying to do analysis of a Beatles song is like using a cannon to try to kill a fly. You know, it's just overkill. The music won't stand up to that kind of scrutiny. It's simple. And it turns out that the music is a lot more interesting and complicated than most people who were dismissing it thought. But it must be pointed out that most people who were dismissing it didn't really know anything about it. Mm-hmm. They just assumed it was simple. But so that's all changed. And now when we approach a piece of music, we approach it with the same spirit of analytical rigor that we would approach a piece by Beethoven or Brahms. We may not always use the same kinds of techniques because the richness in popular music is not always in the same dimensions of the music as we find it in classical music. And what's interesting about that is it begins to suggest new ways of thinking about music that can then be transferred back to classical music. So for years, we never really thought a lot about things like timbre in classical music. I mean, 20th century composers did, but we don't. You know, a lot of people are talking about timbre and Brahms or Beethoven. Yet, somehow, looking at recording studio technique and seeing how pop musicians manipulate it to tremendous effect actually causes us to look back at the Beethoven and Brahms and maybe notice things in that music with regard to timbre and orchestration that we might have looked right past because we weren't really concerned as much with that as we were with form and harmony and motivic development, things like that.
Yeah. So, in a sense, you can learn more about each of those repertoires from each other.
I think it's mutually beneficial. Yeah. I mean, the more in which we're all just musicians working together to talk about music, trying to be fair to the music and trying to not put one music ahead of the other, I think is all to the good. And it's a case not only with scholars, but also with our students. I firmly believe that the more students who do different kinds of music who are sitting in the same classroom together, the richer that classroom experience is.
Yes, I completely agree. And so, when you're in Rochester or at Eastman, do you teach a Beatles class specifically?
I do. I teach one for non-majors, which is, you know, kind of come one, come all, don't be afraid. The music teacher's going to teach you about the Beatles. And then I teach one that's more of an analysis class for Beatles for upper-level undergraduates and graduate students. The Eastman graduate students will come over to take it over on the River campus where I teach a lot, and then our upper-level undergraduates. And they make a pretty good group of pretty smart musicians. And we look at those pieces in great detail. Mm-hmm. And again, with as much rigor as if I was doing a class on the Beethoven string quartets or something.
Yeah.
The students love it. The interesting thing is that when I do a Beatles class, I mean, students self-select into it. So, you know, I get the students who already know Beatles music.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that they already know the music. So I don't have to teach them how the songs go. You know, even among my Eastman students, the most devoted classical musicians, if I do something on Beethoven symphonies or string quartets or the music of Mozart or the music of Brahms, I have to teach them a fair amount of music before we can even start to talk about it critically. But when they come into the class, as they do for most of the popular music classes, and they already know a lot of the music, we can get to a higher level of discussion about it quicker because they already know the music I'm talking about. I haven't got to take time to sort of work through to sort of teach them how the music goes. So there are some built-in benefits to teaching popular music that have to do with some of these aspects of critical thinking that we use so much or promote so much in the university.
Let alone the accessibility in the culture.
So. Yeah, and people get bit by the bug, especially the non-majors. They get bit by the music bug by taking a class that they find, you know, they can really relate to, and then they want to take more, and they want to know more, they want to learn more, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Good for us, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
So your first song you played was a middle period Beatles song,
right?
For No One. So as we move into your second song, I'm wondering, is it from a different period? And well, then what would you say your favorite period of Beatles music is?
I love the early Beatles music for its energy and its upbeat character, mm-hmm. and for the sheer craftsmanship with which mostly John and Paul crafted those tunes. But the songs that really stick with me are the ones from the second half of the Beatles' career from 66 through 69. So my second song I like an awful lot is John Lennon's "Across the Universe."
Ooh, very good choice.
Yeah, that's the one. If you're going to think about Lennon initially being influenced all the way back in 63 and 64 by Dylan, you know, so he starts to think about crafting the lyrics in a way that is poetic and suggestive and maybe even a little bit whimsical. There are a couple mm-hmm. different Johns. Right? There's the John Lennon who, you know, takes a circus poster and does Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, or reads from the back of Timothy Leary's A Psychedelic Experience for Tomorrow Never Knows, or mm-hmm. talks about reading a paper for a day in the life, or is inspired by an ad for milk formula with Cry Baby, all right. Cry, right? There's that John. And then there's the fun play with words John, you know,
I'm the
happiness
walrus,
is a warm gun, yeah, mm-hmm. glass onion, that John. And then there's the guy who kind of reveals himself a little bit. You hear that, you get a bit of that in Julia, certainly Across the Universe, a little bit of that in Strawberry Fields, In My Life. And mm-hmm. of all of those, my favorite is Across the Universe.
It's interesting. In the Playboy interviews, I think they were going through the whole list of songs, and John said, well, what do you think of Across the Universe? And John said, it was a great song of mine that was recorded badly. I felt like they weren't giving it their, you know, very good performance. I was out of tune. I was depressed. And he's kind of had he loved the song, but had kind of a bad feeling about it.
Yeah, and, well, artists can certainly be self-critical. It's hard for me to think of the recording that we're used to as being a bad recording. Maybe there's a little bit of sort of Phil Spector. You know, so when it was redone and re-released, without some of the Phil Spector quiet. It's funny, when Paul wanted to bring back the Get Back Naked mm-hmm. album, and he thought, well, we'll get it back to what we originally had intended before Phil Spector messed it all up.
Ruined everything.
Yeah, yeah, and the fact is, most of us who are used to listening to the old album, all we heard was a record full of familiar songs with missing parts.
Where are the strings? Yeah, where's the brass?
Hey, this isn't what I'm used to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's funny, once an album becomes that iconic, it's very different to go back and monkey around with it, you know, mm-hmm. and I think Paul found that out.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think Across the Universe is just my favorite moment of John Lennon. Just, I like to think of it as just he and his guitar and a kind of,
yeah.
And maybe you've seen the lyric sheet for that, but mm-hmm. it's
great stuff.
Yeah, sure.
So which recording would you like us to play? We have the anthology demo with sort of the Indian instrument, I forget what kind of, it's a sour something in the background, or we have the Let It Be version, or the non-Let It Be.
I would say the Let It Be one is the one I fell in love with, although the other ones I find very interesting.
Okay, well, let's listen to the Let It Be version of Across the Universe.
Are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me.
Across the universe. So we've got a middle period and a late period song, but I imagine in your Beatles Coursera course, we have to talk about everything. And
that's
so
right,
can you tell us a little bit about what Coursera is and what is this all about? It's this whole idea of an open access course.
Well, they call these things MOOCs, and MOOC is an acronym for Massive Online Open Course. And so the idea is that no matter where you are in the world, if you have an internet connection, you ought to be able to take these courses. They ought to be free, and you ought to have access to some of the top professors in the top universities around the world. They've been primarily, the schools involved have been mostly American ones. MOOCs are basically free courses. You don't get any college credit for it. You know, it's not like taking an online course from distance learning from a university. Those are fantastic too, but the idea of MOOCs is that they should be gigantic and available and open to all. So I often say that my classes aren't so much courses as much as they are a series of public lectures organized like a course. But nevertheless, they are organized like a course. And the Beatles course, for example, was originally designed as a 6-week course. And so that means there's about 90 minutes of video per week, but broken up into chunks that are about 10 or 11 minutes long. We found that, or Coursera has found that, if the video starts to get much longer than 11 or 12 minutes, people start to drift off.
Yeah.
But if you keep them, if you chunk it like that, people will watch one video after another. At the end of each video, there's a little quiz to see if you've kind of gotten some of the main points.
Mm-hmm.
And then every 2 weeks, you take a quiz, and if you score 70% or better on all the quizzes, you get a certificate that you can download from Coursera that essentially is something like, you know, I completed this course, and it has the university logo on it, it has the Coursera logo, and a genuine simulated signature from me.
Oh, very nice.
What's funny about, again, the organization is Coursera, which is spelled like course, C-O-U-R-S-E, with an R-A at the end, Coursera. And if you go to that website, you'll see tons and tons of courses. What we found, we're approaching 300,000 students in all the courses that I've taught. I've taught four, one on the Beatles, one on the Stones, and then a two-part history of rock class. They're currently on demand, which means you can join that course. You just go to Coursera, you hit the button, you can start in week one, and you can binge all weekend and go all the way through week three or week four if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Or, Beatles fans, you can just sign up for the course and try taking all the quizzes.
Ah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and
testing
find
knowledge.
Out, well, if you don't do as well as you thought, you might want to go back and watch some of those lectures.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I'll bet you a lot of your listeners could test right through it because they already know the music and the facts. I mean, I'm not trying to uncover anything new. I'm trying to give a guided tour through the Beatles music for people who love the music but never really sort of read every single book on John, Paul, George, and Ringo. And so those courses have been very popular, but what we've found is that most of the people who take them, probably 60 or 70%, are outside the United States. We've counted as many as 165 countries where people have taken. For a while there, I was big in Brazil, big in China, places like that.
Huh.
Now, most of them, again, about 60 or 70%, have got an earned bachelor's, master's, or PhD, and they're most of them over the age of 30. So the people who aren't taking the class are college students between the ages of 18 and 22. When you think about it, why should they?
Yeah,
they're already
in
taking
college.
Classes.
Yeah, right.
So it's really, it makes it available to people who really can't come and take a class Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. You know, it turns out that these are people who are already educated, who are kind of like education junkies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they binge on courses like this the way other people binge on Orange Is the New Black on Netflix or House of Cards or something.
Right,
and they really enjoy the courses. I've gotten, in many ways, the students who have taken these courses have been more dedicated students than my undergraduates who are sitting right in front of me in the classroom taking the real. You know, the in-person version of the same thing.
Yeah. When I was sifting through some of the videos, I saw that one of them where you mentioned that you're not able to play music, which,
of course,
the Beatles are, you know, copyright is awful.
I thought that was going to just be the kiss of death when we started this.
Yeah.
But, you know,
so how do you deal with that?
Well, what we found out is it was a non-problem before we even before we even had a chance to deal with it. So, you know, when the first class launched, the History of Rock was History of Rock Part 1 was the first one that launched. Within the first 24 hours, I thought I'd hear all the screaming and crying the music not being there. But instead, what we got is within 24 hours, people who were taking a class had already created playlists of the music, you know, on various places, Spotify, that kind of thing. And then one guy just put it all up on a server in the Soviet Union where they don't care anything about copyright. You know, and they didn't just do the songs that I provide listening guides for. They did every song I mentioned.
The whole thing.
So we're talking about these long lists of stuff. And so, you know, I mean, when you think about it, it should have been obvious. People who are techie enough to want to take a course online probably are not going to have too much trouble finding the music, especially Beatles music. I'm not saying they'll pay for it, but they'll definitely
find it.
Yeah, so it turned out to be a non-problem in all of my courses.
Well, that's good, and especially now a lot of it's, you can get it on YouTube or
it's
wherever
available. You just can't, it would just be a waste of server space to put the music up to stream. The only thing I can't do is I can't play a piece and talk over it the way I would in class and say, okay, now listen here. Listen to that guitar line coming in. Now see here, now they're coming back to this. That's the kind of thing I can do in class that I can't do in Coursera. So there's still a reason to come to the University of Rochester and take my course there.
Exactly. Very good. Or the University of Missouri, Kansas City,
there
where I will be offering class as well. But you also do other things besides the Beatles, and you've written textbooks, including a very popular one, What's That Sound?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and that's
in the fourth edition.
Fourth edition, which is a big deal. And that would be for if you're a university student taking a general elective class on the history of rock
and
roll.
That's right, yeah. It starts with sort of the birth of rock and roll in 55. The first chapter takes you back to pre-1955, the world before rock and roll. Covers most of American popular music for the first half of the 20th century. And then we get Elvis and Little Richard and all that. And it takes you, really, most people want to teach up through about Nirvana and grunge into the 90s. There are other people who want to take it into the more recent music, but really, you need a 20 or 25 year window to really talk about history. I mean, it's, you know, it's okay now for us to talk about Michael Jackson and Madonna because for all intents and purposes, their careers are done, you know. And most of the grunge groups, it's pretty clear, you know, the alternative scene, that's pretty much played out, even though people like Dave Grohl are continuing to have fantastic careers. We can really talk about the 90s with some confidence. But once you start to get to, I mean, we could talk about Napster, that's 1999, 2000, how much it's changed the music business. But that period, from about the launch of Napster in 1999 to today, is still so much in flux that it's very difficult to do anything more than give students a quick guided tour, but you really can't ask quiz questions because nothing's really very established.
No, it's very
ephemeral. We're still deciding. It's all still in flux, as I say.
What do you like writing about more? Do you like, I mean, obviously the Beatles and Stones, but do you find it's harder to write about music that you're maybe not as fond of? So,
well, I mean, I said before I was born in 59, so I'm 56 years old. The older you get, the harder it is to keep current on what's happening today. And so, you know, for the last 20 years, I've had my nose buried in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s as I've been working on that. On these books and various kinds of publication things, and I really haven't kept current. And so I'm, you know, if you want to know something about what's going on with a singer that's really popular right now, you ought to ask somebody else. Probably somebody's about 30 years younger than me, you know, and they'll know. We all self-select that way.
Sure.
And this is the way. This is the kind of a generational thing that happens in scholarship generally. I mean, people. Among musicologists, there are some people who only do Baroque period music, and they only do German Baroque, you know. And so it's typical for us to kind of get I try to stay as open to these things as I can, but to have a specialty, there has to be a kind of narrowness. That's kind of what specialty means. And narrowness means you can't talk about everything.
Exactly. Well, we'll wrap up with some sort of rapid-fire questions
here.
So. What guitars do you own now? Because I've seen all these. I can't. Do you own all of the guitars that you've
seen? Yeah, I have a lot of guitars. That's what happens when middle-aged men and disposable income come in, and you don't sell anything for 20 years. You can accumulate a lot of instruments. But I love my Beatles-style guitars. I've got a reproduction, Rickenbacker 12-string, 1963 reproduction, I think. Those are way overpriced, but if if you're like me, you got to have one. I've got a reproduction of the Tennessean that George played in 65, and the Country Gent, an updated version of the Country Gent that he played on the Ed Sullivan Show. I've got one of those Paul Hoffner basses. I've got a Paul Rickenbacker bass. So those are kind of, that's kind of my collection of Beatles guitars.
I want all of them. So.
They're great. And you know, I play in some groups that do some Beatles, and every now and again we'll do kind of a Beatles show, and I'll get them all out, you know. We'll have a chance to actually play Beatles on these instruments. I've got a Vox AC30 that, you know.
The amp, yeah. When you're lucky enough to live near House of Guitars.
And, you know, it really is different once you start to... I mean, musical equipment really is a lot cheaper than, like, boats or cars.
That's true.
Lakeside homes and that kind of thing. So you can actually have a lot of guitars for not nearly as much as what most other people spend their money for recreation on. So
that's a good
my
thing.
Story, at least, and I'm sticking with it.
Sounds good. So... what do you think of solo Beatles music, and do you have a favorite? Which Beatles solo music do you find the most interesting?
Well, I think that there are some problems with Beatles solo music. It's much more uneven with all the guys. Ringo's actually the one who's the most consistent, but I think that's because so much of what he did was engineered by other people. I mean, there's the Ringo singing voice, but that's most of what his solo stuff is. But Paul's pretty inconsistent. Some fantastic stuff next to some stuff, boy, oh boy. And John the same way, you know. George has got some great stuff, but also some stuff that's not so great. And I think it's partly because they didn't really have anybody to tell him no. I mean, who's going to tell Paul McCartney, hey, Paul, that thing, that just kind of sucks. You know, who's going to tell him? And so they're all used to hearing yes. And so I think that was one great thing about, especially those three, George, Paul, and John together, is that they had grown up together, and so they really could critique one another. And sometimes that felt bad, just like it feels bad to be put down inside a family. You know, you build up these resentments, and that's part of what broke the guys up. But at least it kept the quality up. You know, and so you know, amazingly, I mean. Among those albums, it's just find me a real clinker of a track from the Beatles. You know my name. Look up the number. Maybe is not up to their usual standard, but it's still a lot of fun.
Still fun, exactly. Yeah. So in our Tug of War, we just did an issue or a episode about Tug of War that was just reissued and remastered, and we talked about how that was like a return for McCartney because he had George Martin back producing it, and sort of somebody to say, you know, you need, you know, that maybe that's not such a good song, and let's get a little quality control.
And in the first couple of records, you know, George Harrison, All Things Must Pass, you get a lot of tunes that he was trying to get the guys had been trying to get the guys to do,
right?
You know, for Get Back and for some of the earlier stuff, and you get John's songs. You know, when you go through some of the demos for the White Album and Get Back and into Abbey Road, you hear tunes that end up in their solo career, sometimes with lyrics changed, same thing with Paul. But then once they start to get to about 72, 73, it starts to be the stuff that they've written since they've been in the Beatles, and that's where things start to... I mean, the John Lennon Imagine album, it's tough to find a bad track there.
Great album.
Paul McCartney, Band on the Run, you know.
All winners.
And the All Things Must Pass, a fantastic record. I mean, the Apple Jam is what it is, you know, it's a jam. But, you know, but they're still running on the fumes from the Beatles and what they had there. And then after that, it starts to get a little more uneven. I mean, still, you can take a greatest hits of John Lennon in the 70s, and it's better than most of what other people were doing in the 70s. It's just that you do probably have to select some things.
Exactly right. So how can we find out what you're doing? I know, close by telling us a little bit about the Popular Music Institute at University
for Popular
of Rochester.
Music. You can get to that easy just by going to rochester.edu/popmusic.
Okay.
And on that, you'll find, you could look at my course, you could take my courses through Coursera, but if you go to the online button, link, you'll see all of my courses. I also have all of those Coursera videos listed on my webpage, on the webpage there. Anybody who's interested in my writing can go to the website academia.edu and just plug in my name, John Kovach. And my page will come up, and everything that I've written, not the books, but every article that I've written is available there. Most of them for download. The ones that aren't downloaded are linked to some website where you can read it online. So
it's really easy to get to then.
Well, that's the thing. You know, that's the way it is today. You want to make everything just a click away.
That's very true. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Do you want to know my third song?
I'm going to get to the end.
Okay.
So
Sorry.
I've got to find out, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I was going to say thank you again for taking the time to speak and share a very different perspective for our listeners. And Chris will be back with me. I think our next episode is a Rubber Soul 50th anniversary coming up soon.
Up in 66.
Yeah, it's coming out. So I want to know your final choice here. For heard a middle song,
we've heard a John song, we've heard a Paul song.
Okay,
so now here's a George song.
All right,
and I'm a big fan of George. In many ways, he's my favorite Beatle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the most masterful of all the George sort of East meets West songs that he ever did is Within You, Without You, which I think is just one of the most fantastic things ever recorded.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a fantastic, and people hear it a lot. You know, I know it's the sort of archetypal, you know, George, mystical George tune.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, it may not be the best song he ever wrote, because he started to become really quite a songwriter without all the Indian stuff, you know, sort of around the White Album time.
Mm-hmm.
But Within You, Without You is definitely one that always gets my attention. If it comes on the radio or on Sirius XM or whatever, I let it play all the way. And I'll stop the car and just and listen.
It's got
a magical effect on me.
What would you say to somebody who skips it because they think, oh, it's just the Indian song, I want to get to the next one on Sergeant Pepper.
To each his or her own. But for me, that's not one that I'll ever skip.
All right. And on that note, we'll leave it there and we'll go out with Within You, Without You. And I want to thank John Kovach again. So
my pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. And we'll talk to you next time.
When we find it to
can't see. Seen me.